Ships at Sea. Mike Malloy here. Welcome to tonight's program. As you know by now, the oil spewing from the Deepwater Horizon well has stopped gushing into the Gulf of Mexico. When I first heard about this today, I thought, oh, God, no longer trapped in, what was that movie, Groundhog Day. I'm not waking up every morning and flipping on CNN and go, oh, there it is, Jesus. But as the day wore on, you know, my excitement, if that's the right word, to know that this gusher has stopped was certainly tempered by all the reports now that this is a temporary thing. They still have a pressure test to do. We won't know until noon Saturday, about 48 hours, yada, yada, yada. And if a hurricane comes, all the ships have to leave. And if all the ships have to leave, that means it's just going to continue to spew because they haven't stopped the Deepwater Horizon mess from spewing up oil. They've just made it so it can now be collected. It's not spewing into the Gulf. So if a hurricane comes, the way I get this, and I may have it completely bass backwards, but the way I get this, if a hurricane comes, the ships collecting the oil will have to head for shore, head for, I don't know, some hidey hole someplace to get out of the way of the hurricane, which will take 2 days, and then 2 days to come back, plus whatever time the hurricane rips and snorts through the Gulf of Mexico. So we're looking at 4 or 5 days. If that's the case, then during that 4 or 5 days, back into the Gulf of Mexico. So I guess what they're doing is testing everything to make sure that there are no cracks or breaks in the in what's beneath the bottom of the ocean, the rock, where the what do you call that? The drill or the well or the casing? I don't know. The thing that goes down to the oil pool, which goes another 12,000, 15,000, nobody seems to know, feet down, another 3 miles underneath the surface at the bottom of the ocean, the Gulf. So it is temporary, and hopefully it'll become permanent, and hopefully this madness will stop, and now we'll begin the 30-year process of that part of the Gulf that BP has destroyed to cleanse itself, because there's not a whole lot that humans can do about this. They can pick up the surface oil. They can get the lumps of petroleum that are washing up on the shores, but where it concerns the estuaries and the wetlands south of New Orleans, they're kind of screwed. Audio screw-up at Ustream feed. Now what? I just got an email. All right, let me take a look here. Let's see. Jesus, I get tired of this. I say we get rid of Ustream. I'm tired of it. No, maybe it's just the volume. How's that? No, here, let me pop this down. Is this it? No, that's not it. How about this? Is this it? Maybe that's it. There, I think that was it. Okay, that should do it. All right. Let's get rid of this Ustream. I am so sick of this. I really am. I don't like being on camera anyway. Hopefully that'll fix it. If it doesn't fix it, let me know. So anyway, I digressed. El Presidente said, quote, it's a positive sign, still in the testing phase. We'll have more to say about it tomorrow, end quote. The COO of BP, Doug Suttle, said this afternoon, quote, we need to be cautious right now. It's a great sight, but we're far from the finish line, end quote. I get so sick of sports analogies, don't you? I mean, Jesus, God, can't people, why not use poetry analogies? Why not use Shakespearean? Why is it always, well, we knocked it out of the ballpark. Well, we're close to the finish line. Well, you know, it's fourth quarter and, we got 3 seconds on the clock. Well, you know, it's the ninth inning, two out, it's full count. I mean, what? Thad Allen. Admiral Thad Allen, U.S. Coast Guard, who is the commandant for this operation, said the test will continue. He also said, quote, we're going to get a new seismic reading off the floor of the Gulf that will tell us, as a result of that testing at high pressure for 48 hours, was there a change in the wellbore? Is that, that's what it called, the wellbore. Okay. Or did we have oil leak into the formation and form a pocket that could be a precursor for a breaching the ocean floor? What the hell does that mean? You know, I ought to ask Michael in Roswell and Prairie 2, because these guys have been telling me no such thing. Well, Prairie 2 has. No such thing as breaching the ocean floor. It doesn't work that way. Well, here's something for Prairie 2. As of the moment, the oil well is completely capped, assuming the pressure doesn't go too high. There's no need to collect oil. If the pressure doesn't come up, then there are casing leaks, and they will have to collect all the oil or let it spew until the relief well plugs the well from the bottom. Yeah, well, I didn't get to that part yet, Bruce. Thank you, though. Yeah, it's temporary because they're still drilling relief wells, two of them, I think, to finally get into the well bore, the bore hole, the bore thing, the whatever, and fill it up with cement and hair oil and whatever else they're going to push in there. But this is, you know, this is a little upsetting here. I get all this upsetting stuff, and I've been sending it to Prairie 2 for explanations. I send him stuff, you know, I'll get stuff. Oh, there's a methane bubble under the floor of the ocean that's going to erupt. And the last time this happened, 80% of all living things on Earth turned into jelly. You know, and I send him stuff like this, and he'll deconstruct it and say, you know, this is bat stuff. This is not true. This is blah, blah, blah. Well, one of the things, Bruce, you've said to me is that there's no such thing as cracking the ocean floor. I think in the sense that Admiral Thad Allen means it here when he says we're going to have a seismic reading, pressure, was there, or did we have oil leak into the formation and form a pocket that could be a precursor for a breaching the ocean floor? Quick, Bruce, send me an email. Let me know what the hell that means. And then Thad Allen says, or is there methane gas coming up, which would be a precursor as well? That Allen goes on, once we are satisfied there are no indications that we've compromised the integrity of the well bore, or we create an irreversible position of oil leaving the well bore, then we can go back and put the system under pressure again. And once we're convinced we've done no pressure to the well bore and it can withstand the pressure after another seismic run, after that 40 hours, we can certainly consider shutting in the well. He didn't scream like that. But what I saw today on several cable news programs, yeah, I did. I spent some time today, and what I'm finding out that the morons in the media now. I don't go to these rat-infested right-wing websites, but the morons in mainstream media, in corporate media, whether it's over the air or cable, are now asking how badly this spill will hurt the Democrats and Obama in the next election cycle. Why are they asking that question? I mean, Obama and the Democrats had nothing to do with this. These were directives that set this up from the man with no pulse. The man with no heartbeat. Oh, my God. Yeah, Dick Cheney. No heartbeat. No pulse. And because his heart isn't going blump, 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 there's nothing there. Can you imagine? But anyway, the question should be how badly the spill will hurt Republicans. And, of course, the answer to that is not at all. And why is that? Because American voters are morons. And whenever they're not morons, the proprietary... Can you cut that down a little bit? The proprietary... information in the voting machines changes the results to whatever they want. We'll be right back.
go to bed angry. Let Mike Malloy do it for you.
21 past the hour. Kate in the desert isn't buying any of this. She says it's a load of crap from BP. It is feel-good PR to take our attention off the fact that something else is going on. The back pressure caused by blocking in that new valve, the pressure is apt to unleash the hounds of hell under the sea. Oh, gee, thanks, Kate. Between you and a few other people, I'm just getting, you know, this stuff really freaks me out. It really does. It completely, it's just horrifying. Oh, well, let's move on. Let's move on. You can go to your live stream of the wellhead or the top, the cat, whatever it's called, and you'll see that no more of that hideous. It just looked like blood from hell. It looked like all the collective blood of all the Republicans who have gone to hell in the past, 5,000 years, just bubbling up. Right, that's gone. Thank God. Pink Floyd, for the first time in a number of years, Pink Floyd reunited for a benefit concert in England to raise money for young Palestinian refugees. That's according to MSNBC 2 days ago. Roger Waters and David Gilmour, joined by a full stage of keyboardists and drummers. Yeah, well, you got to have that. Both picked up the guitar to play for the more than 200 fans gathered to see this concert in Oxfordshire. The reunion, nobody knew it was going to happen until the curtain went up. And there you have Roger Waters and David Gilmour on the stage. You know, a bunch of people went to a club to see a local band or something. The curtain goes up, boom! There's Waters and Gilmour. Can you imagine that? The proceeds from the concert went to the Hoping Foundation, an organization that focuses on the next generation of young Palestinians, mostly refugees. The projects of the Hoping Foundation, check them out, Hoping Foundation. Their projects include a film workshop, a scouting group in the Balata refugee camp near Nablus, and a UN Relief and Works Agency yearbook. The event raised over $500,000 to benefit the group. How did they do that with 200 people there? I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. Waters and Gilmour played a number of classic favorites, including Wish You Were Here, which is that the one we, no, that's the one we play at the start of the second hour, right? We play the Royal Philharmonic version. And Another Brick in the Wall, Part 2. And Roger Waters, by the way, has been involved in pro-Palestinian activism for years. In 2006, he spray-painted Tear Down the Wall on Israel's West Bank separation wall in the city of Bethlehem. And he also worked with the UN to produce a short film about the wall's impact on life in the West Bank. So, good on you, mates. Absolutely. The other night when we mentioned that Thule Kupferberg had died, and I didn't think anybody would really know who he was or who the Fugs were, but just when you think you know everything, you get an email from Max, someone like Max, who writes, one of my favorite bands was the Fugs. By the way, I'm a Vietnam-era Army veteran, unlike Republican war-promoting draft dodgers. While I was stationed overseas in 1971-73, we used to listen to the Fugs, and they were a breath of sanity amongst the insanity and stupidity of U.S. Army life. They literally saved our minds via their fun and political music that sang truth to power. Bottom line, it is people like the Fugs who rescue the United States. The fascists like George Bush Jr., Richard Cheney et al., who, as you rightly say, hate America, destroy America. And then some nice words and so on. And I like the way he signs with a quote from Erasmus, the Dutch Christian humanist. Didn't think I knew, did you? Dulce bellum in expertise. Dulce bellum in expertise. which I guess loosely translated would be, war is sweet to those who have never experienced it or lived it. Thanks, Max. I'm glad, very happy to get your email regarding the FUGs. That just seems like that's a different era, different time, different place. Oh, sure, it was 60s and 70s, and even before that, really. But and it was real performance art, not in the sense of the kind of performance art we know about, but it was, you know, painters who also played music, and musicians who also did sculpture, and sculptors who also knew how to beat out a rhythm on a drum. Those were the days. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Molloy. Stay with us.
Primal scream you suppress. Embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Molloy.
Nobody was ever gonna get sized down. Originally.
25 before the hour. So I'm getting the program ready tonight and or late this afternoon, and I get this email. Actually, it came in tonight, very late. I get this email from Bob Alexander out in Seattle. He wanted to know if I ever saw Mel Gibson's Jesus snuff film. You know, the, what was it, The Passion of the Christ. And no, I haven't seen that. I did see the one that Mel Gibson made about the indigenous people in... were they Aztec, Mayan? What was the name of that movie? It was all done in their language, I guess, which was just, it was a horrifying film. But as far as the Jesus snuff film, no, I liked the one, what was the one where Jesus did not really get crucified and he went on and married... Last Temptation of Christ. Now, that I thought was pretty cool. But Bob writes, did you ever see Mel Gibson's Jesus snuff film? Now, this is appropriate because I got this right about the time I was, I was watching, I had TiVo'd it. I was watching a little bit of Entertainment Tonight, the screaming Mel Gibson. He sounds just like me. He's screaming. He's drunk on his ass and screaming over the phone at his live-in girlfriend or whatever. They have a child, I guess. This guy's out of control. I mean, Mel Gibson is a real crazy person. And, you know, it was my little voyeuristic treat for the evening. I got to listen in on Mel Gibson's screaming phone call. And I immediately, you know, felt very guilty. So I'm listening to that, and I get this email from Bob. Did you ever see Mad Max Gibson's Jesus snuff film? I avoided it when it came out 6 years ago, but for seemingly baffling reasons, I watched it last night. Question mark, explanation point, question mark, explanation point about 10 times. It was amazing, Bob writes. Up until last night, I thought these three films, The Ten Commandments, Ben-Hur, and The Greatest Story Ever Told, were the best tools an evangelical atheist would ever need. He's referring to himself. You make some crazy Christian watch all three movies, preferably strapped down a la Clockwork Orange with the eyelid propers in place. And then at the end of the Marathon of Madness, you quietly ask, you really believe in that stuff? The last night, I saw True Madness. On any level you want to pick. I don't know if old Mel is crazy because he's an alcoholic or if he started out a full-blown loony and then turned into an alcoholic loony is irrelevant. He's made the sickest, craziest, most perverse movie ever. And then Bob quotes from Wikipedia their entries on The Passion of Christ, response from evangelicals. The Passion of Christ received support, and this is when it came out a couple, you know, several years ago. The Passion of Christ received support and endorsement from most known evangelical leaders and representatives of USA's conservative church organizations. Billy Graham, James Dobson, Mission America Coalition, Salvation Army, Promise Keepers, National Association of Evangelicals, Campus Crusade for Christ, Focus on the Family, Pat Robertson, Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, Trinity Broadcast Network, Rick Warren, Southern Baptist Convention, Jerry Falwell, he's dead, Max Lucado, Young Life, Tim LaHaye, Chuck Colson, Lee Strobel, Northern Baptist Theological Seminary, Mothers of Preschoolers. Mothers of Preschoolers? Wikipedia goes on to say, the United Methodist Church stated many of its members, like other Christians, felt that the movie was a good way to evangelize non-believers. As a result, many congregations planned to be at the theaters, some of whom set up tables to answer questions and share prayers. And then John Tanner, pastor of the Cove United Methodist Church, Hampton Cove, Alabama, said, quote, they feel the film presents a unique opportunity to share Christianity in a way today's public can identify with. What in the hell does that mean? Now, I've seen enough of the trailers, and I've seen enough of this and that to know that this movie could only have been made by an insane person who wants to... I don't know. What does Mel Gibson write? I want... And anyone who believes in Jesus, in whatever level they believe in him, how do you get satisfaction watching the mortification of his flesh? One time when I was a Shanghai Methodist teenager, I was about 14, and for Easter, our youth fellowship group's leader, a really strange lady, decided that we were going to do a play about the crucifixion of our Lord and Savior. And I got to play the part of Simon of Cyrene. Do any of you know who? Well, of course you do. So as Jesus walked past, a la Mel Gibson, being beaten into bloody strips of flesh by the Romans, I, as Simon of Cyrene, a black guy, I was to step out of the crowd and offer to carry the cross because the Savior was being flayed and strips of flesh were coming off. And we all had our scripts. And I didn't memorize the words. And all of a sudden, I don't know how this happened, somebody hit the fast forward button on a time machine. All of a sudden, it was Christmas morning. I mean, Easter morning. And I hadn't learned the first word. I don't think I'd even opened the script. This is like the actor's dream, which I have had before, where, you know, you're all set to go out on stage. You don't remember a bit of dialogue. In fact, I had that happen to me. But this was for real. I hadn't opened this. I hadn't looked at the script. So it's Easter sunrise service. It's like past sunrise. It's about 7:30 in the morning. And there might have been 250 parishioners in the basement of the church where the stage was. So the play, you know, we all get down there. And, of course, I'm sweating bullets because I don't even know. I have no idea. I don't know anything about. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't have my lines. I don't have the blocking. I don't have anything. There was no real rehearsal. I think there were two rehearsals, but both of which I missed. So here we are. I'm Simon of Cyrene, the black guy. And so I'm looking at the script. I'm trying to remember what I'm supposed I've got like 10 minutes to memorize the script, right? Well, it didn't work. So when Jesus and the Romans went past me, you know, I stood up in my robe and I said, "Can I help?" which was not, it was a bit. Well, the kid playing Jesus, you know, just kind of looked at me like, "Can you help?" Well, let me just draw the curtain on that scene. It just reminded me when we had the Methodist church. I'm sorry, Bob. I just got digressed there. So back to what Bob says. Of course, the sick blanks who make up the crazy Christian religious right loved the film. I'm sure it spoke to them. I shudder to imagine what it must be like to be the kind of bull goose loony that love that movie. If we could, for just a moment, see the inner workings of the thought processes of the people who flocked to the Passion of Christ, we would beg the white-coated attendants for even more LSD in order to come down from that hellish trip. Regards, Bob! Yeah, I know what you mean, man. I know what you mean. Like I say, I did not see the movie, and I won't, because I just don't like that kind of violence, unless it's being perpetrated on a right-wing fascist or something. Dick Cheney doesn't have a heartbeat, and he doesn't have a pulse. Son of a... I mean, there's nothing there. No heartbeat. How do they take his blood pressure? I mean, isn't the diastolic and the systolic when the heart is going like that, right? How do you take someone's blood pressure who has no heartbeat? I mean, was that story real?
Oh yeah, and I read that they're trying to spin it. His minions are trying to spin it as if this is some kind of beneficial, wonderful thing that's going to give him all this quality of life, when the reality is he has something dangling from his armpit that the batteries have to be changed twice a day.
And he has to plug in at night.
He's got to plug in at night, and it's only his life expectancy is less than 2 years, even with this thing.
Well, but they're going to get him a heart. Are you kidding me?
He may not be a candidate.
Oh, they're for a heart transplant?
Right.
Why?
He could be way past that point.
I didn't think any of you, my friend Jerry, who had a heart transplant, he was about 2 millimeters from dead, and it worked.
Not everyone's a candidate.
2 years.
But Jesus is the man and our salvation, and every war we wage is in his name. We think his Bible should be taught in every nation, and we'll bomb anyone who doesn't feel the same. Welcome to Jesus' land.
Endless possibilities there, where so much can come true. And you think of the beautiful things a child can do.
He's a liberal with a microphone, and that makes him dangerous. It's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. I'm just looking at a website here. Somebody sent me a link. DharmaRose.com. Dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A, Rose. DharmaRose.com. Wow. This is some good stuff. I'll send you we got to order some stuff out of this. DharmaRose.com. All kinds of stuff. This is really cool. Dharma Rose. All right. I have an answer to the from both Michael and Bruce about the seafloor breach that the good admiral is scaring the hell out of me with. First Prairie 2, Bruce writes, if the casing is leaking somewhere below the surface of the bottom of the sea, it could be filling a strata fairly shallow underground that would leak out somewhere, maybe miles away. But that doesn't mean an extinction event. Just another big mess. You don't want to get it flowing because it could be impossible to stop without drilling a bunch of wells to drain it. A seismic reading reveals pools of oil fairly easily. And Michael writes about the oil leakage pressure relationship. It is confusing, but most of this has to do with the condition of the well casing, something they simply cannot determine except by inference. I guess the well casing is what goes way, way down through the rock. If the cap is secure, that's what they just put on, and the pressure is high enough, oil and gas will escape around the broken well casing at some point well below the surface of the ocean bottom, if it's broken. They're trying to use seismic data to determine if the earth above the point of the break in the casing is strong enough to resist leakage. That's where the so-called fast flow paths that I mentioned in an earlier email enter the picture. They know that the earth has fissures, especially if it is largely sandstone and clay, and they're trying to figure out if the well is going to leak from one or more locations, which may actually be quite remote from the wellhead. There are a multiplicity of scenarios possible. One, the pressure is still very high and capping the wellhead springs leaks elsewhere. That's why there's little point in showing pictures of the cap, which is what we're all looking at on television, right? Two, the cap alone will cause leaks elsewhere, but those will be greatly reduced as long as the suction tubes to the surface are operating, preventing a buildup of pressure in the cap. Or three, the earth is secure enough to resist the pressure created by the cap on the wellhead. Okay, one thing, Michael Royce, to keep in mind, the high pressure is in part due to methane in the pool, in the oil pool. And both methane and crude oil have been escaping virtually uninhibited and unrestricted for 3 months now. It just might be that the pressure in the pools finally come down enough to make capping possible, with suction or possibly even without it. BP would never say anything like that outright because it would indicate they had no effective plan to control a break in the first place, except letting it bleed down. All right, boys, thank you very much. I appreciate it. There you go. So we're not going to have this huge caldera-style explosion. Boom! You know, where the entire Gulf of Mexico rises up, and we all have, oh, maybe a couple of hours to say goodbye to each other. Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. What's this? Oh, never mind. All right, we have, we don't have time to do this. I have my report from Bruce Enberg tonight, our economic affairs correspondent, the title of which is The Log Has Eyes. Ooh. I haven't read it yet. So, The Log Has Eyes. All right, we'll do that for you when we come back. Praying for Dick Cheney. This is from Tim in Los Angeles. Mike, let's prove to the world there is no Jesus or the Holy Spook in the clouds and pray to Jesus the following prayer. Dear Jeebus, I know that I'm a sinner and don't speak to you much. And I know that I take your name in vain by yelling blank or blank. But if you do me a favor, I promise to tithe 10% of my money to you to a right-winged evangelical church for a year if you allow Dick Cheney to die. I mean, he has no pulse or heartbeat, but can you kill Dick and send him straight to hell, please? Thank you, Jeebus. Love and peace, Tim from Los Angeles. I've gotten a lot of those in the past couple of days. You know, people think, I'll talk about how Cheney, you know, this mass killer, I feel no mercy for him. Would you feel mercy for somebody who's responsible for mega death of your own people and people? No, I don't anyway. This guy's been a killer for 40 years, 50 years. To hell with him. May he rot. But when I say stuff like that, there are these little blog sites around that record this program, these little right-wing nests of vermin, and then they feed it out to anyone who will take it. And then I usually get a bunch of emails from half-illiterate freaks. Well, they're totally illiterate. Half-literate freaks who post it, Free Republic, EnslavedRepublic.com and some of these other right-wing garbage heaps. So, you know, I just read the stuff that people have been sending in about Cheney, and some of it's really funny. It's all very, very dark and very macabre and very, very, I would say sick, but it's nowhere near as crazed as something I would say. So, you know, it's pretty hard for me to call something sick where it concerns Dick Cheney's rotting body. No heartbeat, no pulse. Oh, my God. Whew. That must be weird. I wonder how he sleeps at night. No, I don't. We'll be back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Molloy. Regarding Cheney, if your Freeper fans are listening, and as always, are clueless, please advise them to Google Cheney's secrets. TV News Lies, History of Cheney, comes up first of nearly a million possible sites that tell them like it is. They might learn something, or not. Just a thought. Reg. Yeah, so, listen, for you right-wing morons... Why would you do anything I would suggest, right? But if you really want to know about your boy, Dick, do that. Google Cheney's secrets. It's Cheney apostrophe S because it's the possessive, you morons. Oh, my God. My new copy of Harper's arrived today, and I'm holding it in my hand. It is the August issue of Harper's. And on Harper's Index here, percentage of their personal income Americans paid in taxes last year. Now, when I saw this afternoon, I'm flipping through. I always go to Harper's Index first and then scan the contents page. But this caught my eye because all I have been hearing, especially here in the buckle of the Bible Belt, down here in Georgia, where all these right-wingers are trying to outright-wing each other, and I mentioned this the other night, no matter who the candidate is, the opponent, the right-wing opponent, links him to Obama. It's just the Republican. No, I'm not talking about, this is not a general election. I'm talking about these runoffs and primaries. And, it's just so bizarre. It is so vomitous. It is so disgusting to watch these white men and white women, mostly white men, seeing who can out-socialist Obama in their campaign. It's pretty incredible stuff. And one of the things these crazy candidates are talking about is Obama's taxes. Oh, he's raised taxes. The truth is he's lowered the taxes on 95% of Americans, but he got legislation passed that did that. He didn't do anything. He got the legislation passed. But what is amazing to me is the continuing lies from these filthy bastards. It just never stops. Every time, you know, it's an old joke. It's not a joke. How can you tell when a Republican's lying if his mouth is moving? But I don't see why people keep buying into this nonsense. It is simply not true. The other thing that these right wingers are trying to convince the voters is that the tax rates in this country are too high. Oh, that's why we're in this, you know, Obama raised the taxes and the economy collapsed. It's all his fault. Well, Harper's Index has it here, and this comes from the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis. The percentage of their personal income Americans paid in taxes last year, 17%. The last year in which Americans paid so little, 1971. And then this, the percentage of all U.S. personal income last year that came from wages and government programs, respectively. Now, this they're making the point here. You hear these right-wing lying scum, whether they're in a campaign mode or they've been elected and they're just lying to the American public. You hear them all the time talk about, well, you know, all this government money, these government programs, you know, why don't you go get a job? The number of the percentage of all U.S. personal income last year that came from wages and government programs, respectively, 52-17. 52% of all U.S. personal income last year came from wages. 17% came from government programs. And then the last one. In trying to explain those two figures, 52 and 17, the number of years since record keeping began in 1929 that these figures have been so low and so high, respectively, zero, which means the records have been kept since 1929 and never has the percentage of earned income versus government programs been so wide. I mean, the difference in the two numbers been so have been so wide. Separate. What the hell's the word I'm looking for? So every time you hear one of these right-wing pieces of human waste talking about the taxes are too high, please. I mean, if you want to believe that, well, okay. But because if you're a right winger, you'll believe anything these rat bastards feed you. But for normal people, if you're not a Republican, if you're a normal person, you're not going to believe that garbage. From Prairie 2, the log has eyes. Weekly jobless claims were down 21,000 for last week, but still far too high to indicate growth. And the number's wrong anyway. Any week with a Monday holiday shows a drop like this. The number to look at is continuing claims, which is up a full 250,000. And this doesn't allow for people falling off the back end of the compilation. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reduces the number of unemployed workers because they no longer count them as human beings, simply because they have gone past 99 weeks without finding a job. They are forgotten ghosts, and they should keep moving. There are no jobs here for you. Keep moving. Even if you have a job, things are probably not that good, with the average worker only working 34 hours per week. Your wages are falling, and likely you are being encouraged to do work off the clock as well. The job growth touted last month was weighted heavily with service workers, and more than half of those were temps. Indeed, factory output indicators are showing a serious slowdown taking hold, and capacity was only 74% as it was. The uptick in business over the past year was almost entirely the rebuilding of inventory depleted early in the crash. Cash-flush companies have sought to reduce their cash holdings, as having too much money can make you the target of a takeover bid by the bigger fish in the pond. But inventory expansion cannot continue, and the market for goods will start contracting rapidly, triggering more layoffs. What with millions of people suddenly running out of unemployment benefits and the certainty of massive state and local government layoffs, then retail sales will certainly start to suffer, eliminating retail jobs as well. Signs are that retail sales are already starting to plummet, even if the month was only down 0.5%. Yeah, that figure just came out yesterday, I think. While some big retailers showed gains last month, this was mostly due to them eating their smaller competitors alive. If credit should tighten, as it did in 2008, you will have a sudden spate of retailer bankruptcies. Deflation is what is behind the eyes of the crocodile whose toothy head is just below the surface of the economy. Producers have lately been unable to raise prices, and manufacturing is becoming more and more sluggish. So panic selling in a market with no buyers could take the economy for a death roll in the swamp of the Great Depression. Don't look behind you. That log is watching you. PrairieNumeral2.com. I hope you people go to his website and print these things off. Because they're very interesting to read. They're pretty scary, yeah, but I have yet to see his economic writing be wrong. I haven't. So go to PrairieNumeral2.com and print off all kinds of stuff. We'll be right back.
Right here, right now, Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. So, an email here, I read something that Bill Maher suggested on his Twitter page months back, and I think it should be seriously considered. Here's what he said, quote, "Every a-hole, whoever chanted drill, baby, drill, should have to report to the Gulf Coast today for cleanup duty," end quote. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Where are you right-wingers, huh? Where are you cowardly bastards? You know, you want somebody else's sons and daughters to go fight in a war. You want somebody else to clean up these messes that you advocate in favor of. Where are you? You scum-sucking right-wingers. God, I hate you. I really do. I mean, you're so disgusting. This is from who? It's from SJ. I wish you'd include just a little name. Hey, Mike, never written in or called. Went on the Mexican Riviera cruise with you in October of 07. Told you I named my cat Malloy. He's a cool cat. Been listening to you ever since Air America days. I'm an associate adjunct math professor here in L.A. I get emails like this, and he's included it for me, all the time from acquaintances. This whole backlash against Obama is so racist, and white people are so afraid this country is going to be taken away from them by the, brown people. I've heard some of these acquaintances mention, quote, if Obama signs an amnesty law for all these illegals, then say goodbye to the U.S., end quote. The majority of ignorant, unread people in the U.S. don't know the blame way with behemoth corporations and the dismantling of America using the Chicago economics ideology combined with free trade laws. Free my ass, free equal Orwellian speak for no regulation or oversight for corporations so they can kill and pillage at will. Also, the problem lies with the war industrial complex, anti-union laws, suffocating social spending like education and health care, the revolving door between industry and those who make our laws. Let's blame the welfare mother who gets a measly $800 a month, not Halliburton, Xee, Monsanto, Wall Street for their billions in no-bid subsidies and taxpayer dollars per year. Having read Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine and reading this email this morning makes me think the corporatocracy would want Obama to sign his amnesty law to further sink this country into slavery. Then teabaggers and right-wingers will have Obama to blame. Maybe that will incite the revolution, except then maybe people won't know who they're fighting against. Or, like you said, that's exactly what these corporate kings want, for people to fight each other, to kill each other. More resources and space for their own hungry appetites. It's difficult to have conversations with people who don't know history and the true reasons how this country is being dismantled. This country is full of uneducated people. What kind of a country do we live in where privatized prisons get more funding than education? And then he sends me a... a mailing that he got that is real, you know, anti-Obama for all the wrong reasons. I mean, that's the other thing I said before. I don't understand at all. You know, Obama is a corporatist. Obama is continuing the worst of some of Bush's policies. Now, Obama has done a few things that are not terribly bad. But he has not done anything that remotely resembles what a liberal or a progressive head of state would do. He just hasn't. And yet, the teabag crowd and the Republicans and the right-wingers hate him because he's black. And he has no business being in the White House. That's a White House. It's not a black house. It's a White House. So that's why they're, you know, like I said last night, and I'll say tomorrow and tonight and the next day and 10 years from now, the organizing principle of the teabaggers and the Republican Party is flat out blatant racism. That's why every time I see a man or a woman who is African American who claims to be Republican, it's like a chicken claiming to love Colonel Sanders. I mean, it's just madness for these people. Or log cabin Republicans. A gay Republican? Are you insane? Well, of course you are. All right, we have a break here. We will come back and provide some more entertainment for you momentarily. I think we're going to have some out music. There it is. We'll be right back.
sky. Here's Mike Malloy.
Before the hour. Now, I want to address this next little bit to all you right-wing crazy people out there, you Republicans, you teabaggers, you suckers, in other words, with your little signs about Obama being a socialist and all this other stuff. In the first place, you don't have a clue what socialism really is. I am a socialist. Obama is a corporatist. But that means nothing to you. And also to the liberals out there who sometimes send me emails about, you know, I should stop chewing on Obama's ass about his policies, because after all, if we didn't have Obama, we would have McCain. Well, that's certainly a point worth considering, but stop, please, you Democrats and you liberals, you progressives, stop thinking of this man as anything but your, not Obama, but his policies as anything but your enemy. I'm serious. Listen, Dan Frumkin, who is a senior Washington correspondent now for Huffington Post, used to be with, wasn't he with the Washington Post before he got too independent? A leading big business group responding to a request from top White House aides last month submitted to Obama's Office of Management and Budget a 54-page hit list that takes aim at regulations protecting the environment, workers, consumers, and investors. Okay, you get this? The Obama, a couple of senior advisors, Rahm Emanuel and Valerie, what's her name? Valerie Jarrett? Is it Jarrett? This list was requested by these top White House aides, to the business community. What would you like us to change? Obama's people said that. Having asked the Business Roundtable for its advice, the White House was then faced with the question of what to do with it. Discussions between the two parties are ongoing, the White House says, and their conclusion may depend on who wins the ongoing power struggle between the president's top political gurus and his policy apparatus. The push to placate business leaders is being led by senior advisor Valerie Jarrett and chief of staff Rahm Emanuel. But just like the advice the White House politicos are giving Obama about pressing forward with deficit reduction in the midst of a jobs crisis, that's not a smart thing to do. The idea of loosening the reins on big business at a time when the cost of deregulation has been so viscerally on display in the Gulf of Mexico strikes some observers as spectacularly tone deaf. Not just bad policy, but bad politics. Now, this is your liberal this is the president and his advisors that the dumbasses out there, the teabaggers and the Republicans and the right-wingers call a socialist. Rena Steinzor, law professor, University of Maryland, president of the Pro-Regulation Center for Progressive Reform, said, quote, "What we're in the middle of is a string of regulatory failures that the Obama administration seems very insensitive to." She cited the financial crisis, the Massey Energy Mine disaster, and, of course, the BP oil spill. Professor Steinzor told the Huffington Post she suspects Obama's political team is not motivated by the optics in this case, nor by an overwhelming devotion to the free market, but rather by money. Obama's political team is motivated by money. Not what you and I see on our TVs. Not because they are devoted to the free market necessarily, but by money. The professor says, quote, "They want campaign contributions. They want to win. I think they definitely are trying to make sure that they don't fall behind in the fundraising race. I think they're quite worried about that," end quote. She went on to say, quote, "If I were them, this isn't what I'd be worried about. I'd be worried about people being so angry about BP that they wouldn't vote for the president," end quote. Gary Bass, executive director of the Pro-Accountability Group, OMB Watch, Pro-Accountability, that's the good guys, said the business roundtable should be embarrassed by its insensitivity to the regulatory failures that have cost the nation so much in recent years. And he scolded the White House for soliciting the group's advice on regulation in the first place. Bass told the Huffington Post, quote, why the White House would be catering to this kind of rhetoric smacks of election year politics instead of governing. What I continue to see in this administration is a battleground between the politicos and the policy people, whether it's deficit versus stimulus or regulatory matters, end quote. Now, this is not to be confused with the really crazy bastards at the National Chamber of Commerce. Frumkin says, the exchange between the Business Roundtable and the Obamaites was much friendlier than the recent volleys between the White House and the increasingly radical right Chamber of Commerce, which yesterday sent the White House its own four-page list of priorities, which included, are you ready, deregulation of business, tax cuts for the wealthy, free trade agreements, a reduced corporate income tax, expanded offshore drilling and logging in national forests, and the privatization of waterways and roads. Privatization of the Mississippi River! The chamber's demands, requests, whatever you want to call it, earned it a tough letter signed by Jared and Emanuel. The letter said in part, quote, now this is where they sound very anti-business or pro-liberal or something. Anyway, Jared and Rahm Emanuel wrote, quote, we will not accept the lax regulation of the financial industry that led to the greatest economic crisis since the Great Depression, and we will not stand by while oil and gas companies continue to fight needed changes to outdated regulations that are partially responsible for one of the worst environmental crises in American history, end quote. But this business roundtable discussions are still a go, with the group's representatives returning to the White House in the, quote, near future, end quote, a White House spokesperson told Huffington Post. Professor Steinzer sees trouble ahead. She says, quote, they've made great appointees to the federal agencies, the Obama administration has, and then choke-chained them from the White House. They can't do anything. Political interference in scientific decisions remains a reality, the professor said. One example cited by her group relates to the Office of Management and Budget's meddling in EPA scientific determinations about endocrine disrupting chemicals. And much like Obama's long promised rules for scientific integrity, his promised rewrite of the regulatory process is more than a year late. It goes on. You can find this at Huffington Post. But the point simply here is that if it's not Obama, then he has surrounded himself with people who are destroying further, in my opinion, irrevocably, the Democratic Party. It doesn't exist anymore. We had a guy out today, an appraiser. And a nice white guy. And in the course of a little conversation, you know, he said he was that rarity, a white Southern Democrat. But he could no longer associate with the Democratic Party because he felt that it was just going crazy. It was involved in a nervous breakdown, and there was no there anymore. And he and I discussed this for Aunt Kathy. The three of us sat there in the kitchen and talked about this for a few minutes before he left, about what has happened to the Democratic Party and how people, the fact that he's a white male Southerner is really beside the point. I just said that to identify him. But this was a guy who said he was brought up as a Democrat because the Democratic Party always stood for the worker, the working class, the little guy. People like me, people like the appraiser that was here today, maybe people like you. And they don't anymore. And the gist of our conversation was you cannot vote party anymore. if you're a Democrat. If you're a Republican, you'll vote party until, you know, somebody cuts your throat. And probably another right-winger will cut your throat in order to steal your food eventually. But if you're a Democrat, you can't vote party anymore. You just can't do it unless you're just willing to be a fool. What you have to do is what we've talked about in this program, which you probably do anyway, and that is vote the candidate. Unless it's a Republican. I mean, don't, do as you want, because really your vote doesn't matter anyway. Not in certain precincts or certain districts or certain states or certain whatever. But the idea of voting Democrat because the person has a D after his name or her name is ludicrous. It's insane. It doesn't make any sense at all. And it was just an interesting conversation. Because usually when, you know, we get people come out to the house, to the compound here, you know, after we frisk them down, make sure they don't have any weapons, and they find out that I work in talk radio, you know, and then they find out my position in talk radio, it's usually, oh, you're a liberal? We'll be right back. Deflation that Bruce Enberg was talking about in his report for tonight. Michael also wants to add to that, because like so many of these economic terms, it's a little bit difficult for most of us, not that I speak for anyone but myself, but it's been my experience, it's a little bit difficult for most of us to really get a handle on not just what the terms mean, but how they apply. I mean, I think all of us know what deflation is. All of us know what inflation is. But how does that apply to to what you and I do in our daily lives? Well, as Michael writes, deflation should make any manufacturer pee his pants in fear. But when the economy is controlled by banks, largely profiting from speculation, deflation becomes an end in itself because asset prices decline, making those assets much cheaper to acquire for those with wealth, be they individuals or corporations. Remember, it was banker and Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon who said, quote, "It is during depressions that assets return to their rightful owners," end quote. And we do know exactly what he meant by rightful owners, don't we? Having raped the third world through disaster capitalism, the banks are now setting their sights on us. And I sent this on to Bruce, who writes, "This has been the practice of bankers since there have been bankers. Inflation requires borrowing. Deflation causes defaults. And before the New Deal, bankers could call loans in, call them due at will, even if not everybody could pay. And remember, mortgage, the word mortgage means death pledge. Mortgage, death pledge. So people did pay. After deflation, they could buy everything for pennies on the dollar and start the cycle all over again, since everybody needed loans to start over after 10 years or so of starvation." So, yeah, and so thanks to Michael and to Bruce for the quick explanation. They have us in a death grip. I mean, this goes on all the time. The difference here, during the Great Depression, there were what, 140 million people in this country? Now they're 330 million? And during the last depression, there was no such thing as the global economy. It was all national economy or local economy. So as has been pointed out by these two guys several times, we were able to recover from a depression because we still had the physical plants here. We still had the factories here. We still had pent-up demand for stuff made here. So when the bankers, during the Depression years, finally got tired or ran out of ideas to screw us with, or the government under FDR said, okay, that's enough. When that finally happened, the physical structure was still here to recover. So people could go back to work. And of course, FDR stepped in with jobs programs to fill that gap, to give people income so that people would start wanting and being able to afford refrigerators and radios and bicycles and lamps and bedspreads and whatever. But that stuff was made here. A, we don't have 145 million people in this country anymore. We have 330 million. B, the physical plant of these factories has been utterly destroyed. Go online and look at any series of pictures of Flint, Michigan. If you want a classic, hell, go to Toledo, Ohio. Go back to my hometown. Look at the pictures. And see the global economy now, where the capitalists have said, all right, we got what we wanted from the two Bushes and from Clinton. Deregulation of the financial services industry. Deregulation of regulations. And we just about completed it, they say. All we ever wanted was to move everything offshore. All we ever wanted. I mean, our companies are set up in a P.O. box in the Bahamas, but we still had the damn factory here. We still had to pay union wages back when there were unions. We don't have to do that anymore. Now we have China and Vietnam and the North Mariana Islands and Indonesia and the Philippines and Benin and Nigeria and wherever. So they have us in a vice, truth seeker, they being the financial services industry, the bankers, in other words, the capitalists. Let's just say it like it is. The capitalists, they've got us. They won. They spent the past 75 years trying to destroy what Roosevelt put in place. Because what Roosevelt and the Congress back then put in place was a system of checks and balances. Financial, economic, checks and balances. So that what we're experiencing now wouldn't happen. But FDR and his brain trust never considered NAFTA. They never considered shipping everything out of the country. And I guess it's because they figured, well, the first loyalty of Americans is to America. The first loyalty of American employers is to American employees. Of course, this is back in the day when the capitalists would make 30 or 40 times what the average worker made. Now it's 300 or 400 times what the average worker made, except the big capitalists, you know, like the Rockefellers and the Carnegies. But that's going way back. So they've got us. They've got us by the throat. Now, the question is, what to do about it? I don't have a clue, except for Malloy socialism. I like that. It's 7 past the hour. We're going to take some calls here momentarily. We'll be opening the lines in a couple of minutes. Irish Dave has a couple of fun facts. During the Great Depression, about 90% of Americans lived in rural or semi-rural locations, and nearly 50% of Americans were food self-sufficient. With the latest depression approaching, about 10% of us live in rural areas, and of the total U.S. population, less than 5% are food self-sufficient. Yeah, you can only have shelves big enough to hold in your basement, big enough to hold so much canned goods is pretty too... You know, I did that. I don't know, whenever he was really hammering on that get canned goods, I don't know why I never did it before. I used to watch my mother and my grandmother do it. Of course, my grandmother canned everything that grew in her garden. She had a huge garden. My mother did a little bit of that, but she was too busy working to support a family. But there was always, in my mother's pantry, there was always stacks of canned goods. When she died, my sister and I went through it all and found stuff that was, 2 years past the expiration date. Not that Mom ever would have eaten that, but, you know, you put that stuff up, and it's hard to remember when you bought it. But anyway, after listening to reading Prairie 2 stuff, on and on and on, that buy canned goods, you know, we finally started doing that. I'm serious. And I watch the expiration labels very close, or dates very closely. But we have a stash now. We probably have enough stuff stashed away that would last, I don't know, probably 6 weeks. And then we die. Let me see what we got here. I have been suggesting give it to the Republicans. Let the Republicans win everything, which will hurry up the collapse of the country. Several people who listen to this program are not comfortable with that. Genetic Liberal writes, if Republicans regain the House, Obama could then more easily continue, one, to wage imperialistic wars, two, neglect climate change, and three, divert most of our tax money to the filthy rich. The implication being, if Democrats retain control, it'll be a check and balance on Obama. David writes, Mike, you say you want Republicans to win. Well, if they do, this is their plan, courtesy of the right-wing U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Yeah, we just mentioned this. And what he sent me is an email that went to him from Democracy for America. David, yesterday the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a right-wing political group representing large corporations, proposed what it's calling an economic recovery plan. Here it is. Privatize Social Security, cut taxes for the rich, log the national forests, expand offshore gas and oil drilling, privatize highways and waterways. Look familiar? That's what the agenda of a Republican Congress looks like. And the Chamber of Commerce plans to spend more than $50 million to make it a reality. And so on and so on. And David added a postscript, Mike, the Republicans are getting crazier and crazier and moving further to the right. So far to the right, they're making the Kaiser and Mussolini look like liberals. When you say you want these crazy bastards to win everything, it irritates me. We have not recovered from the last 8 years. It will take longer to recover from. The only way to recover is to increase Democratic majorities in Congress, where the Republican obstruction will no longer work. David. Well, I tend to agree historically with that. I probably still agree with it, David. But the Democratic Party am I wrong? Yes, the Democrats are not Republicans. They're Republican light. But how close are they to becoming full-fledged corporatists, the Democrats themselves, with a few exceptions? There are no exceptions in the Republican Party, I understand that. Maybe my idea sucks. I do talk radio. Everything I say is subject to revision, correction, and cancellation, actually. So I don't know. David, you may be right. My idea of giving it to the Republicans to hurry the apocalypse, the economic apocalypse, in order to rebuild and restore, and it may be nonsense on my part, total nonsense. So, all right. Sam in West Virginia also doesn't like the idea. He says, Mike, this is what I foresee happening when the Republicans win back Congress big this November and the presidency in 2012. The strategy of divide and conquer will be writ large. The chuckle nuts here is remembered for the Roe strategy of blaming liberals, gays who want the rights to marry, illegal, undocumented immigrants, and the threat of internal terrorists. The promotion of these fears will pale by comparison to what will happen when the corporatists, fascists operate unimpeded, aided with great fervor by the swill that is the corporatist media in this country. The millions who will be left to fend for themselves out on the streets, foraging for nuts and berries, will be prompted to fear and blame these same false shadow scapegoats and much more. They will blame everyone but the oligarchic Wall Street fascists that have reduced them to serfdom. All known liberals will be killed, starting with people who have Jewish-sounding last names. Often, victims will succumb to public lynchings or other vigilante activities. There will be few token interventions by law enforcement. The transition to modern-day feudalism will be final and unassailable. The continued and enhanced corruption of the atmosphere by greenhouse gases will promote climate change that will render the Earth uninhabitable for people and most other species by the end of the century. Sam in West Virginia. Okay, folks, like I say, anything you hear on this program, you have to take with as much salt as your diet will allow and your blood pressure, right? I would much rather, I've said it before, I'd much rather have Malloy's idea of democratic socialism than a Republican takeover. I just don't see it happening. What is it? Nationalize these industries: banking, energy, healthcare, transportation, and weapons production. And you nationalize weapons production so you can utterly end it. So the banking industry, which is the financial, not all financial services, certainly not credit unions. There's no reason to nationalize them. They don't do this speculative nonsense. Insurance companies, I'm talking about the big, not health insurance, but life insurance. Those companies should be, probably should be included in that. But energy, the production of energy, the distribution of energy, healthcare, obviously, single payer, transportation, I believe that the government should have a monopoly on that, like high-speed trains. There should be a national airlines. And if competitors want to get in the game, go ahead. But what has private enterprise done about high-speed trains in this country? And, of course, weapons production, that goes without saying. Now, that would leave entirely on its own small businesses, family-owned farms, high-tech firms, all sorts of startup businesses. Those are left alone as long as labor and environmental laws are followed. And I would much rather have that than a Republican victory. But what are the chances of getting that, huh? We'll be right back.
This is a time for action, because the future's within reach.
past the hour. Joe in Oxford, Wisconsin writes, canning? Why isn't it called jarring? You know as well as I that canning is the industrial method with all the metallic contamination, but jars are what our moms and grandmoms used. I wish I had learned jarring, Joe in Oxford. Yeah, I don't know why it's called canning. I have no idea, but you're right. Jarring. Sandra in Madison, Wisconsin writes, Mike, throughout my life, my father, an artist and a teacher, would often speculate on the political, social, and economic direction America was headed. He believed as a nation we were destined to lose our status as a superpower and become a third world nation. As he grew older, he watched in real despair as our civil rights gave way to manipulated fear-mongering, wiretaps, torture, and a disdain for human rights. Corporate rape of the resources, land, and the people is, quote, business as usual, end quote, in third world countries. BP's handling of the oil flowing into the Gulf of Mexico signals a real change in America's status in the world. It is our so-called little people's livelihood and landscapes that are being destroyed. America is feeling the same pain as the Ohlone minority in Nigeria, what they experienced in the 1980s and 1990s. Shell Oil or BP, the actions, attitude, and pillage is the same. I do not view this tragedy as a comeuppance for America because it is the struggling middle-class people and the wildlife of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Florida that are being affected, not our corporate leaders. Those who have the power to say no more instead chant, drill, baby, drill. The corporate monolith sees itself as above the law. It ridicules, belittles, and dismisses its critics as Marxist greenies and environmental terrorists. They seem to be calling all the shots. Government officials and reporters can't get in to see what is really happening, and BP forbids cleanup workers to wear masks. People are dying along with the birds and the fish, and our government, like those in most third world countries, is powerless to stop this. BP is holding the so-called little people and our government hostage in their pursuit of big profit. They feel mighty put upon that they are being held minimally accountable in this crime against creation. My father was right. We've become a third world nation. Sandra in Madison, Wisconsin. Stephen is calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Hey, Stephen.
How you doing?
Hi. Is this
the banker?
Is Steve the banker? I was going to say, is this Steve the banker? Hey, Steve.
It is.
Hello. Hello.
I got it. Hello.
Yeah. I'm here.
I got to tell you, I'm going to tell you something that I shouldn't tell you.
Oh yeah.
You're really doing it's a brilliant show tonight.
Oh, well, thanks. Well, that's because I'm getting so much input from so many people here. It's, you know, I'm the conduit.
Well, you're saying so many things that are so damn important.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. But just keep in mind, what you hear on this program comes from a lot of people. It's filtered through here. But that's nice. Thank you. I appreciate that.
No, I'm actually very serious. And actually, while you were talking, a couple of very serious things went through my mind. One, you know, in another lifetime, if there were shows like this, you know, during, let's say, World War II, and people in the Warsaw Ghetto were able to hear shows like this, you know, et cetera, et cetera, you know, it would have really given a lot of people a lot more hope and maybe a little bit more community across Europe. And it's just one thing that went through my mind. Mm. While you were talking this evening, and that we may end up that way here, unfortunately, among all the things that you said tonight, and all the people, you're right, all the people who provided so much information to you,
mm-hmm.
It's really great, and one of the things that they've provided you over and over again is just how much my industry that I work for rapes people every day, and is deregulated. And thank God they passed something down there in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever they passed, to say the truth, you know what, as much as I'm on it, who the hell knows what they passed. But,
well, you know, I was going to get to that tonight, but we're not going to have time. I'll have to do it tomorrow because McClatchy Newspapers broke it down with a Q&A segment today, and I captured it online. There, somebody sent it to me, and I got it online. And it really answers the questions. Hey, hold on a second. Will you, Stephen?
I will.
All right, I got to take a break. We'll be right back. The financial services, Reform Act or whatever that Obama says he will sign later this week. That has to be tomorrow, doesn't it? There's a lot of nonsense in that, just like there's a lot of nonsense in the health insurance bill. But as Steve points out, there are some things, and I guess we'll get to it tomorrow. We'll be right back.
Your synchronized screaming. It's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. All right, we're talking with Steve the banker in Massachusetts. Where were we?
Well, I think we were talking about, one thing I'd like to talk about is one of the things that you had brought up, and a number of people have brought up, and I'm one of those people that I've been a Democrat since, you know, before I was, you know, put together by a sperm and an egg. I'll probably die once. But I have been a very angry Democrat. I'm as liberal as you can be, even though I've been in banking my whole life. You know, I grew up in New York, working in my father's stores that he owned,
mm-hmm.
and little grocery stores, but emptying trucks and railroad cars full of produce from all over the country. I talked to union guys and truckers from all over the country from the time I was 5 years old.
That's a great education, wasn't it?
Let me tell you something. The food industry is the greatest industry and the greatest teacher of all time. Mm-hmm. Because everybody's got to eat.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, everybody. And so, you know, the guys who bring the apples in are the most important guys on this planet.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, the growers, the farm, you know, this is where it all ties in to everything you say. The farmers out in Washington, the guys who bring it in by rail and by truck, the guys who unpack it in New York City at Hunts Point, guys like me when I was 15 years old and 10 years old and 5 years old, you know, guys in the street in New York distributing it to all the different places and the guys putting it on the shelf. We're all tied together.
Right.
And we either make it or we don't. But the thing that I wanted to say about the Democratic rank and file, people like me who've been waiting one hell of a long time for the Democratic Party to return, the Democratic Party of Roosevelt, the Democratic Party of John Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy. I'm a little angry at this point. I've waited a long time. But we really lost in 2006. That is when we lost. Not in 2008 when we won. We had already lost in 2008. We lost in 2006. When I first started calling you.
Mm-hmm.
In 2006. Because that's when we took back the Congress. But the very first moment we took back the Congress and all the people like me who were excited for the first time since the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
All right, people like me who've been motivated. I've run for office. I've been on the Democratic convention. I've been in the convention as a delegate 3 times in a row now. I've been very involved.
Right.
You can't be more involved than me and more informed. And yet I have not been motivated enough in the last couple of cycles to even not vote. And if you can't get people like me to vote, who is the people who are going to bring the money, the votes, and the, you know, lick the stamps and the letters?
Right, right.
I'm the people who get those people to the poll to win. But Nancy Pelosi, I hate to say it, and people were who were in the Congress for a very long period of time at that point in 2006 dropped the ball and said they're not going to go after Bush.
That's
they're
right.
not going to stop the war.
That's
they're
right.
not going to do the big thing. They killed a movement that we had going, if you remember.
That's true. That's absolutely true.
And it is that momentum that we lost big time. And was really an undertow. As much as Obama won a lot of the new voters, he got back some of people our age, our age. But you know what? He lost both now.
Yeah. Well, he has. He may still be able to retain the youth vote if he can get people to go out and vote again.
I hope so.
But
I hope we all come back.
Well.
But they got to do it.
You know,
motivated.
Like I said, when I had the talk with the appraiser today, I've given up being a party person for the same reason that you have. I mean, political party person.
I agree with
and,
you.
And I hate that phrase, oh, I vote the candidate. I vote the person, not the party.
Yeah.
To me, that was always hog snot. You know, that's somebody's way of weaseling out of a discussion. But all of a sudden, I found myself feeling the same way. Not that I would ever vote for a Republican, but I'm saying,
I know,
I would vote for an independent or a Green or a Democrat. I will still vote Democratic. There's no question about that.
But they got to give us the reason.
Right. There has to be a reason to vote for them. It's no longer because there's a D after their names. And the Republicans still, they're like a bunch of, they're like a bunch of damn sheep. Republicans can't think individually. They do what they're told. That's why Glenn Beck is so worldly famous, and God knows he's probably the Messiah. You should wake up to that, Steve. I know you people have been waiting for one. There he is.
Can I say one more thing very quickly?
Sure, sure.
I'll give you, I just, I don't want to take up too much of your time. This is so perfect of Republicans, GOP, and the fairy tale, tea baggers, whatever they are.
Right, right.
Whatever they call themselves.
Yeah. Tea baggers. Just
tea baggers. Yeah, that's great, isn't
that? Yeah, it is.
But this is, I saw something today in the local paper here in Massachusetts that just says it all. It was part of a blog of a letter.
Mm-hmm.
And the letter was from a local representative who said, you know, a Democratic representative who said, you know, one of the best things that we should be doing, one of the first things we should be doing to, you know, re-spark everything is to put money into education. Which, yeah, okay, that's great. It's a good idea. Okay. But this Republican guy goes, I wouldn't do anything with our money. What a terrible idea. And he went on, but that was it. It was like, let's do nothing. That's so typical GOP.
It is.
Little government, do nothing, no regulation.
Right.
Allow the big corporations to walk all over us no matter what. It's just great. I love it.
And they have an ulterior or a secondary motive, if it's not the primary motive now, and that is to bring down the Obama administration. This is why I have a hard time, and I do. I have a hard time criticizing this president. I have a hard time criticizing Democrats, even when they are crazed like Nancy Pelosi, because the right wingers go after Nancy Pelosi for half witted dumbass reasons. You know, she's a communist. Or she's a socialist, you know, when in fact she is more of an enabler for these fascist bastards than anybody out on the street. Just because you hold up a sign that's been a picture of Obama that's been altered with a little mustache to, you know, some freak's idea of what Hitler looked like, Pelosi has done more to advance fascism by refusing in this country, by refusing to allow the House Judiciary Committee to even open a hearing, even open an investigation.
To be serious and to get back to it, and why I am really angry, and it's really serious. I mean, people have lived and died because of this.
That's right.
The Watergate hearings should be a pimple on the butt of what is going on now.
That's so true. That's so Nixon was out of control, but it doesn't compare to what Cheney and Bush did. And hey, listen, thanks, Steve.
Doing a great job. Take care.
All right, man. Thanks. Appreciate you checking in. Denny again, north-northwest of L.A., writes regarding Cheney. Denny writes, I've been creeped out by the creepiest mofo in our so over, largely by his doing, history. So when it became official that he has no pulse and no heartbeat, I wondered, as you and many others did, what that would look and feel like to be in that state of existence. So quiet inside that hollow tin chest. He's become a freaking hybrid, and you can't hear him coming. It's Rin Tin Cheney in overdrive. Rin Tin Cheney. Oh, my God. Mike in Golden, Colorado writes, as I expect you know, your strategy of letting the Republicans wreck everything that we might rebuild from the rubble has a fine history. If one concludes that the system is broken and cannot be amended, then only two courses of action make sense. To drop out, preferably by leaving the country to a fate that, in this case, it certainly deserves, or to remain engaged as a revolutionary. Once you decide the system is broken and cannot be fixed, it makes no sense to remain engaged within a broken system. One must either leave or seek to sweep it away. A revolutionary who may be peaceful is guided by the saying, worse is better. I think it originated with the old Marxists. It means that rather than trying to mend a system that cannot be mended, we want to destroy it utterly, that it might be replaced. Carried to a ruthless extreme, this would mean politically assassinating people like Kucinich and Bernie Sanders because they are trying to make the system work, and the revolutionary wants to smash it. It would mean campaigning for Sarah Palin. So I guess the key question is, for you and your listeners, do you think the system is broken and cannot be mended? And if so, do you wish to drop out or remain engaged? If the answer to both questions is yes, then worse is better is forced. Mike. Wisconsin. The subject line says, Cheney's heart whirs. He writes, I'll bet that motorized heart of Cheney's is not so quiet. It runs at some thousand, 7,000 or 8,000, 9,000, I think, RPMs, according to the doctor on Rachel's show. That's got to make some kind of noise. I think Cheney probably whirs. Like a blender that's never finished with your smoothie. At least he hopes is never finished. I know he needs to be plugged in at night. Nice. Joe in Oxford. I don't know why the... is he the first person who's ever lived without a heartbeat or a pulse? He whirs like a blender that's never finished with your smoothie. Oh, my God. strikes me as so unbelievably funny. Or that other one about, the other one I read, like, you can never hear him coming. Because... Rin Tin Cheney, oh my God. What is it? What's his wife's name? Lynn. Oh, I wonder what it's like for her to get in bed with him at night. Oh my God. Well, of course, I guess he's in an ICU for a little bit longer, you know. Oh. I mean, you never would have any kind of indication in your chest that you're happy, sad, depressed, hungry, upset, running, nothing, just whirr. And the last one from Bruce tonight. There's a growing coalition in the House around the Progressive Caucus. It includes some blue dogs and others that want to roll back NAFTA and other trade agreements. This could grow into a real reform movement. It's not like they have to reinvent the wheel. All these things were in place for 50 years. So there's a proven model to work from. I hope you're right, Bruce. Regarding canning, Napoleon caused canning to be invented for the war, but never really got any benefit from it. It started with glass jars, but turned to wrought iron canisters. Canister was kind of a generic word coming from the Latin and Greek for basket. So canning became the name for cooking inside a container. Tin cans got their name from the process and not the other way around. Oh, okay. Well, there you go. To our emailer who said, I wish I had learned jarring. It's actually called canning and not because of tin cans. Ta-da. Boy, the things you learn doing this program. Sanchez is calling from Montbello, California. Hey, Sanchez.
Comrade Malloy, the great CEO in the sky, grant you the maximum allowable amounts of profits allowed by the SEC, the Security and Exchange Commission.
Oh, thank you very much. That's prosperity Christianity, I think.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
I don't even know where to begin at this point, but I have my own conspiracy theories about Dick Cheney. I don't think that he got any kind of mechanical device set in it, but if he did, it might have been because he has that black bile instead of blood that flows through his body.
Yeah.
I think it was just a simple oil change that he was going in for, and he's got an oil filter change. That's what it was.
Man, the whole thing just creeps me out. I mean, this man has creeped me out for probably the last 35 years, especially the 8 when he was running the country. But this is beyond creepy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, I can't get my mind around this. That's why I guess that everything that everybody's sending in here about him sounds so hysterical. Funny. It's that kind of scary black humor that you just go, I think I better laugh so I don't start ripping my eyes out.
Well, according to the Alex Bones website here, they're claiming that there was a mysterious red-skinned figure with horns on his head, a tail, and cloven hooves was seen entering the back loading zone of the hospital where Cheney received his surgery, and he was carrying one of those hot foods delivery pouches, you know, similar to like pizzas, and supposedly it contained the beating heart of a virgin teabagger.
Well, really? So it's not a whirring machine yet. No, I'm. You know, enough hints have been dropped by corporate media that it's very clear now that Cheney is waiting for or looking for, and there is a big difference, a heart transplant.
Yeah.
And, you know, the argument can be made, well, he's too old. They don't do it for people over 65 or however the hell old he is. I don't know what the outer limits of a heart age in terms of age a heart transplant is, but or the outer limit is. But I'll guarantee you that it doesn't make any difference to the Cheney factor. If he needs a heart, he will get a heart.
Well, perhaps this is what this BP oil gusher is about. From the depths of Haiti, the devil might be sending a beating heart via the oil gusher, and this is how they're going to be receiving it and sending it to him. So this is the delivery method to give Cheney his heart, because only someone from hell would give up a heart to send to Cheney.
I'll tell you what, Sanchez, you've been reading way too many old copies of Mad Magazine.
I realize that. I know. You know me so damn well.
Hey, I got to go.
Okay. All right.
It's over. Thanks, Sanchez. I appreciate you checking in. Cindy writes, the jokes on Cheney tuning into a battery-driven dildo to be used by Lynn Cheney. Can she tell the difference? I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.